and she took them from him, though she kept them away from her body as if disgusted by them. "These, really?" Aelia said. "This was the object she poured herself into?" She is not sentimental, and she didn't keep a journal, unlike the last chosen one. He hoisted himself up out of the water using the railing, then climbed over it, his limbs heavy for the swim between universes. I needed something she had modified and kept close in order to summon her. His clothes were waterlogged. Aelia set the boots down and performed the working to dry him off, flicking her fingers at his cloak. "You can take that mask off now," Aelia said, cringing. "You look like a melting candle." He unfastened the top button of his shirt and undid the clasp holding the siphon to his chest. The working didn't change his face, but it projected a different appearance to anyone who looked at him, even on Earth. Aelia had told him before that the projection didn't look precisely normal, which was perhaps even more desirable for his purposes. The people of Earth were vulnerable to even the most transparent of workings, given their denial of magic's existence. He had amused himself by reading the latest theories. The Dark One was a government experiment gone awry, an alien invader pursuing world domination, a mad billionaire turned supervillain. The people of Earth, he had decided, read too many comic books. He picked up the girl's boots, and together he and Aelia set out toward the terraces of trees along the Riverwalk. It was before sunrise, and the city was as empty as it ever was. He heard a few cars rushing past on Wacker Drive, the homeless woman on the corner of LaSalle singing to herself, and the snap of Aelia's shoes. He had scolded her before for her ostentatious clothing and unsubtle footwear. It was important to remain discreet on these late-night missions, or someone might notice them. "Is it magic that she pours into the boots?" Aelia said. "I'm afraid I don't understand."
"That doesn't surprise me," he said.
They began to climb the terraces, ducking under the pink blooms of crabapples and eastern redbuds. "And it is a kind of magic, if we think of magic as an energy of will. She has exerted her will over these boots, modifying them and repairing them, putting them on and removing them, just as the boy exerted his will over the paper crane. The origami had survived the journey from Earth to Genetrix in a plastic sandwich bag and was now perched on a windowsill in his workshop. The emotional attachment to the object only strengthens the energy associated with it, which will empower me to summon them both here."
"And you don't know which one possesses the needle?"
"I believe it's the girl, but I prefer to be thorough."
"When will you go back?"
They'd reached the street level. Nero paused and smiled at Aelia.
"Don't tell me you are eager to be rid of me again."
Aelia flinched a little, the corners of her mouth tugging down.
"I merely want to prepare for my relocation if it's imminent."
"We are still several months away from the destruction of these universes, I assure you," Nero said. "I have secured your place in a new one. You have nothing to fear as long as you continue to help me."
Aelia gave a tight smile and led the way across the street toward the Camel. As Nero passed the singing woman on the corner, he dropped a coin into the cup before her. There was no shame, he thought, in giving someone momentary relief, even if her universe was doomed to destruction.
It was Aelia's smile that was the last to disappear, staying steady as the Cheshire Cat's, as a new memory surfaced.
"You are not listening to me," he said.
They stood in his workshop, glowing orbs adrift around them. Nero was hunched over a notebook, scribbling a few stray thoughts before he forgot them. The electricity in the Camel had gone out, so the orbs provided the only light, lending an eerie glow to the new praetor's face.
"The collision is inevitable," he said slowly, as if he were speaking to someone who was quite stupid.
He hadn't thought that Aelia was, but she had displayed a remarkable lack of comprehension in the conversation thus far.
"I am holding the two worlds apart for now, with a substantial portion of my magic, I might add. But once I am dead, they will continue along the path they have been on since the Tenebris incident connected them, toward destruction."
Lightning flashed in the windows, ominous. Thunder came soon after, like a drum roll.
"The Tenebris incident?" she said.
One of the orbs floated next to her ear,
where she wore a gold-plated siphon that came to a point, a reflection of the ridiculous genetrixe fashion trend of women dressing like elven princesses. Her gown was long and loose, with billowing sleeves.
You never told me that was what forged this connection.
What else could have accomplished such a thing?
He scowled at her. The magical core of this planet shattered and sent fragments of genetrix magic into another universe, and due to the instability of time during universe-to-universe travel, back in time. Those shards became magical objects of legend on Earth, but there are so many false legends that it has been difficult to discern the true ones. That's why I must continue to go back and forth between universes. I am considering doing something more dramatic to draw out the truth more quickly. I am tired of stalling the inevitable.
And there's nothing you can do, even with all your power, to sever this connection and save both worlds?
Even if I wanted to, which I do not, I am immortal, not all-powerful, he said. And soon, circumstances permitting, I won't even be that.
I'll never understand you.
Aelia moved toward the windows, which were rattling in their frames from the wind. Rain splattered across them, obscuring the view of the city beyond.
Many would kill to live forever. They would sacrifice their love, their children, every penny they own. And you spend all your time searching for the one who can end your life.
Those who thirst for immortality have no comprehension of it. He walked to the drink cart that stood next to the doorway and poured whiskey into a clean tumbler. For the first 200 years, it is intoxicating, yes. The cut crystal of the tumbler caught the light of one of the orbs and sent it scattering across the floor. But then everything becomes more and more meaningless. A life, a nation, an entire universe, their triumphs, their squabbles, their pathetic grasping at power. It is all the same, no matter where I go, no matter what I do. He sipped his whiskey, the spice of it stinging his throat. I am tired. Aelia glanced at him. She was not afraid of him now as she had been when he first told her what he was and invited her to kill him. He had known she was the right one to tell, because she actually tried to do it, tried half a dozen workings that had taken his breath, stopped his heart, and even attempted to sever his head. He had allowed it, though it was no more than he himself had tried. He had also tied weights to his ankles and jumped into the ocean, self-administered the venom of the most venomous snake on Earth, the inland Taipan, and in one universe hurled himself into an active volcano. All the attempts, his and Aelia's, had failed, as his magic defended and preserved him. Still, she sometimes betrayed fear. Like now, her eyebrows knit together, her expression haunted.
And this boy, you believe he will be able to do it? She said.
I have been in dozens of universes with dozens of chosen ones and warriors and magicians of renown, he said. None have had the raw power of this boy. He may not have the skill or the focus, but I don't require him to. He is a blunt instrument only. Aelia nodded.
But his desire to do so must be cultivated, she said distantly. And desire cannot be forced.
Nero drained his glass. Precisely what I need your help with.
The glow of an orb was what remained.
The door to the workshop shuttered as he flung it open with his siphon and then slammed it behind him. He was trembling. He cursed and shook out his hands. One would think that hundreds of years of life would eradicate this kind of weakness, but still it lingered. He filled the air with whistles, one to lock the door behind him, one to set up a sound barrier around the circumference of the workshop, one to summon his notebook to the table before him, and the last to ready his pen to take down his dictation. He sank into a chair next to a stack of books and used his handkerchief to wipe his forehead of sweat. He tasted salt from his upper lip. The pen stood upright, shivering in anticipation of his voice. "It is done," he said. "The army of flickering is dead." The pen began to move. He ran his hands down his legs to wipe the moisture from his palms. "He will want to kill me now," he added, with some relief.
Sloane felt the hunger of the Dark One. and above all, the weariness. They felt both together.
He thought of Micah and his wry smile. Strange, he had always thought, that such an extraordinary child came from such ordinary parents. Nancy, host of a weekly knitting circle, last year's winner of the chili contest at the town fair. Phil, thinning on top, thickening on the bottom, manager of the local bank. They had eyed Nero's siphon uneasily when he shook their hands, and they hadn't fought him when he took their son away from them. Micah didn't need a siphon to do magic. He hardly even needed intent. His desires simply manifested when provoked. He had lit his first bedroom in the Camel on fire. He had broken every single plate in the cafeteria at once. He had made flowers grow out of the stone floor in the Hall of Summons. Now he sat on top of the siphon fortis in the Hall of Summons, looking small despite his early lankiness. It was the ears poking out of his hair, maybe, that made him look so young. There was a cassette player in front of him, and Sybil's voice, raspy and dry, played for the third time that morning. It will be the end of Genetrix, the unmaking of worlds. What do you think? Nero asked him. Marred by magic, Micah said. He tapped the corner of his left eye. Is that what this spot is, magic? I believe so, Nero said. And though he despised sitting on floors, he sat across from Micah, just beside the siphon fortis. The cold from the stone seeped through his clothes, chilling him. My theory is that the Tenebris incident sent a few small pieces of magic flying, and one of them landed in your eye. Said I, narrowed at him. The Tenebris incident was years ago. I'm only 11. Do you know what a wormhole is? Nero said. Micah shook his head. Let me explain it this way, then, Nero said. A wormhole is like a tunnel. At one end of the tunnel, things can be moving very slow. At the other end, they are moving very fast. So if you go through the tunnel, you can get somewhere far in the future, but you can get there very quickly. Understand? It was how he had lived for hundreds of years, though his own Earth had been in the same century as Genetrix's when he was born. Time did not cooperate between worlds. So the magic exploded and went through a tunnel, Micah said, and landed in my eye. I don't know. It's a theory. And that's why I have so much magic, Micah said. Why my parents were so scared of me. Perhaps, Nero said. And perhaps there is a way for you to keep it under control until you are ready for it. Would you like that? Micah nodded. The poor child, Nero let himself think. Teeming with magic, and not a single person in the world could understand it. Not even Nero himself. Let me tell you, Nero said, about a particular kind of siphon that goes on your spine.
The spine, they thought.
Claudia tapped the vertebrae that stuck out from his shirt when he hunched over. Tap, tap, tap. The fire was low. He had forgotten to add logs to it, and now the air was so cold he could see his breath. It was difficult for him to remove himself from these preparations. He'd been waiting so long for this night, the night when everything was finally ready. The objects of power in a wide circle in the courtyard, connected by a line of salt. He had gathered them over the past 5 years, following legends to dead ends, whispers to treasure. The real treasure, though, ached in his chest. Only an X-ray had revealed it. The doctor had suspected a hole in his heart, and that was, in a sense, what he had found. But the hole had been plugged by something. A piece of shrapnel, he had pronounced it. But Nero had not been near any explosives. There was no immediate danger to his health, so Nero had gone on, short of breath and easily tired, with the fragment in place. He straightened and pulled his suspender straps over his shoulders again. His sister Claudia stood behind him in a smart blouse with a bow in the middle, right above the dip between her collarbones. Her hair was parted on the side and curled at the bottom. "You look pretty," he said to her. "Don't I?" She stepped away and swayed her hips so he could see her long skirt shift back and forth. "I thought I'd dress up for your first day of eternal life." He scowled at her. "You're dressed for the train and nothing else," he said. She gave a small smile. "And you're sure you want no part of it," he said. "I'll have an eternity in heaven," she said softly.
though I am sad my brother won't be there to join me. You will still be here on Earth.
I don't believe in heaven, he replied.
She nodded. So you said. She leaned toward him and kissed his cheek. She smelled of floral perfume. When she pulled away, she still wore that small smile.
The fire crackled in their fireplace as the last of the kindling broke.
The feeling was fire. When a birch log burned, the papery bark peeled away from the wood and turned to ash. That was what he felt was happening to his skin. Every layer of him, skin and sinew and bone, peeling apart and burning to cinders. That was only the beginning. Later, in another universe, when he found the words for it, he would call it plunging headfirst into the sun. Hotter than lava, hotter than any heat he knew, and the sensation of twisting away from it, yanking one's hand off the stove, or smacking the ember that had fallen on one's clothes, was there, but he couldn't move. He had become a cloud of dust, a loose association of particles, and he couldn't scream. It took its own eternity. He had used the piece of something in his heart to dig deep into the earth without lifting a finger to form a connection with purest magic. He had not merely sampled it. He had drunk from it as though a straw, drawing in as much as he could bear, and then more. The connection, having formed, could not be broken, though he was desperate for it to. Not until the pool had drained. When he woke, seconds later, years later, he was alone, and everything that had been alive, every weed in every field, every flower on every tree, every insect that crawled and snake that slithered and bird that flew, and every single human being that had once walked the ground, was gone.
They had destroyed their world and would have to find another.
From the Journal of Nero Dolce, Questor of the Council of Cordis. It is a strange thing to bear the weight of a world. I never thought I would have so much in common with Atlas. For his mistake, for siding against the gods, he spent an eternity with the heavens on his shoulders, not the earth, as the misconception goes, and for my mistake, for delving into the secrets of the universe. I must carry my wasted dead planet around with me forever. But it's not the flowers and the animals that haunt me most, or the trees and the wonders of the deep ocean, or the children whose faces I never saw and names I never knew. There are so many of those things that they fade into abstraction. Specificity, not scope, is what makes a thing meaningful. And so in the end, it is the woman down the street who gave me a slice of bread with butter on it every day on my way to school because she said I was too thin. And the alley cat who wove an infinity sign around my legs when I went outside to smoke. And our upstairs neighbor who taught me how to tie a secure knot. They are the ones who haunt me. And of course, it is my sister Claudia. Sometimes I hate the resurrectionist for the magic he possesses, for knowing how to raise the dead. I have tried.
Chapter 43. The Dark One had tortured Albie with both brutality and delicacy. Sometimes, paradoxically, with both at once. Sloane remembered an array of polished tools. Wrench, knife, needle-nose pliers. They had looked like they were new, just purchased from the hardware store. He had wanted something from her, and he had hurt Albie to get it. She had not given it to him. The Dark One had seemed impressed. He wants to die, Sloane said, and she had almost said, we. We want to die, because they had been so intertwined in his memories. A moment later, she felt revulsion. Her stomach turned. She stumbled to the edge of the grass and vomited. What just happened? Esther said. What did you do to her? I answered her question, Nero replied. You need not concern yourself with how. If you wanted to die, you could have just said so, Matt said darkly. He was hunched over in pain, his crushed hand cradled against his chest. any one of us would be happy to oblige. No. Sloane straightened. Her mouth tasted like acid. She wiped her lips with the back of her hand. Genetrix and Earth are on a collision course. He is what's been holding them apart. Kill him, and we all die. She struggled for breath. He had to die, but he couldn't die. But if they didn't kill him, as he wanted, he might stop holding Earth and Genetrix apart and move on to another universe, another set of victims. And then they would all die anyway. There was no way out. Sloane looked at Mox, bowed under the siphon, his hair hanging in his face. From the beginning, Nero had wanted to shape Mox's desire in order to shape his magic. Nero had formed him like a statue from clay. And he had formed her too. Not over the course of years, but over the course of moments. Offering her the choice between herself and Albi. Walking into the trap she set on the Irv Cupsinet Bridge. Beckoning her toward Genetrix with Albi's voice. But he had never had to change her desires, because what she wanted and what the Dark One wanted had always been the same. I didn't think it was possible, Nero said to her, for you to soften toward me. I haven't, she replied. She walked slowly toward him. Give Micah the needle, Sloane, so he can do what he was made for. Nero said, and he didn't sound malicious. He sounded tired. Or I will have to motivate you. She knew his version of motivation. He had tortured Albi so that she would tell him where their weapons were, where the needle was. He knew the softest parts of her, the most vulnerable parts. He knew that, above all else, she was lonely. Mox was hunched over, his face streaked with tears and sweat. He had been used all his life, she thought. Sloane couldn't let him be used to end the world. Mox wasn't made for this, she said. I was. Sloane, no! Matt screamed, and it sounded like he was shouting into a strong wind. Perhaps he was, Sloane thought. Her hair whipped across her face, obscuring her vision for a moment as Esther lunged and grabbed the throat siphon that rested a few feet in front of her. She held it against her throat with one hand, stuck a whistle in her mouth with the other, and bit down hard. Before she could make a sound, Nero waved a hand at her, hurling her to the ground. Not everything must be lost, you know, Nero said to Sloane. The energy that my death produces could be used to save something. Micah has a well of untarnished good within him, and he might want to save the world enough to preserve part of it. But you have only ever wanted destruction. He was right, of course. Mox had said that magic was an expression of a person's deepest desires, which meant that when she eviscerated the crew during the deep dive mission, when she worked a gale instead of a magical breath in the Hall of Summons, when she blasted a crater into the side of the dome, she had wanted it. She had never done a piece of magic that was not in service of ruining something. Somewhere inside her was a thing that wanted to take and take and take until there was nothing left to give. Just as Nero had done in his own universe. His thirst for power and magic not slaked until the well of magic under his Earth's crust was dry. She lifted her hand, and Nero's body lifted high in the air. His cape snapped in the wind, pulled sideways over one shoulder, the pin up against his throat. The needle sang inside her, sang her revenge. She dropped her hand, and Nero fell onto the pavement, his legs crumpling beneath him. Both broken, she assumed, from the snapping sound they'd made. She didn't care. Something stands between Genetrix and its twin. The Dark One. He said, and he laughed a little, grimacing with pain. We'll excise it. And the worlds will be crushed together. And that will be the end of all. Yes, she said. I'm told the line between a Dark One and a Chosen One is hair fine. A part of her did want destruction, but that wasn't all of her. She wanted other things too. Justice and mercy. Drinks with Albie. Kisses with Matt. Laughter with Esther. She wanted to wake early in the morning, when the light was pale and new, and run to the lake's edge. She wanted to sit in silence in the modern wing of the Art Institute and look at the Frank Lloyd Wright windows and think of Cameron. She wanted to teach Mox how to drive. She wanted to read the entire Unrealist Manifesto. She wanted to watch an olive dance in a cocktail shaker. She would just have to hope that those wants outweighed the others. Sloane raised the hand that contained the needle and imagined herself deep in the ocean, a teenager. And at that time, an expert on the legends of Koschei, the man who could not die, who had hidden his soul away in a needle. The pressure of the water was all around her, and so was the fire of magic, so painful it made her thrash against its hold. But beyond the pain was something else, a hunger pang. She had written in her journal that it was like wanting something so much you would die to get it. An acknowledgement of how deeply and how desperately she did not want to be empty anymore. She imagined herself at the center of a drain, her vision obscured by a wall of swirling debris. The dust marked the path of the air, tight around her shoulders. And flecks of rock, bits of flesh, fragments of bone, embraced her. Her hair whipped around her face, found its way into her mouth, and still her magic beckoned for more. 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 She focused on Nero, her hand outstretched. It was the one with the needle, the one with the web of scars from when she had turned animal, biting at her own flesh to free herself from a trap. And if desire was what fueled magic, then in this case, all she wanted was Nero's life, every minute of it. His eyes bulged, and he brought his hands up to his throat, or he would have if he hadn't at the moment risen into the air, held high above the river. She was in the monument, the light of dead names glowing around her, and she was sitting with Albie at the bar, the line of empty shot glasses in front of them. And she was walking along the road, barefoot, a piece of glass buried in her heel. And she was standing on Genetrix's river walk. She wanted all the things the Dark One had taken. She screamed, the sound scraping out her insides, hollowing her out even further, and she filled herself with his life. The losses he had heaped up like chips at a casino. The magic he had hoarded from the worlds he had walked, possibly hundreds of them, so many he had forgotten their names. She devoured him. Nero's body ripped apart all at once, hovering eviscerated over the city. Guts tumbling loose and dangling, heart still pulsing, attached to the threads of his blood vessels and veins. She saw a tangle of white nerves and the strict lines of his bones, and blood was everywhere, spattering. Perhaps he was screaming, and perhaps he wasn't. Couldn't anymore, with his teeth pulled out of his skull and his tongue adrift on the wind. And then she was on fire with magic, as she had been in Nero's memory, diving headfirst into the sun, disassembling into a cloud of flesh and blood that could not scream. There was no exertion of will, just an extraction of want. As water crashed down from above, the thin membrane between the worlds breaking. Water rushed over the riverwalk, flooding the terraces with their trees, swallowing the cars that drove on Wacker and the pedestrians on the bridge. Sloane rose, or perhaps she fell. She fell down through the water again, up into the rubble of the tower they had destroyed, and slammed, impossibly, into the ground next to the 10 years monument, where they had sprinkled Albie's ashes. Chapter 44. Somewhere nearby, a car alarm was going off, but it was muffled. Sloane felt like someone had packed her ears with dense cotton. She brought a hand up to touch one, found a sticky but clear ear canal. There were more alarms now, a chorus, all bleeding at different intervals. A few security systems chanting about intruders, and sirens coming from all directions. Sloane blinked up at the clouds. It seemed strange that she should be looking up at clear sky, though she wasn't sure what else she had expected to see. She probed her head and neck with both hands for signs of injury, and then finding none, sat up. One ear was ringing, and everything in front of her tipped and spun, which only made it look more unreal. In one direction was the river and the Dark One monument that stood beside it, a modest bronze block with a gap of an entrance. And in the other was the undulating steel face of Genetrix's Warner Tower, looming over the skyline. Across the street from her was half of 300 North Wabash, a simple black structure of steel and glass. On its eastern face, its innards were exposed, as if the building had been sliced like a block of cheese. Sloane watched as half a couch, cut clean through the center of a cushion, tipped back and plummeted 20 stories to the pavement. Sloane's mind had gone blank. Her body ached down to her fingernails. She tested her legs, found them shaky but mobile. "The others," something whispered in her head. "Find the others." She crawled on all fours over the concrete for a moment, then lurched to her feet and stumbled toward the river. She felt like she was drunk. She saw a dark head surface and ran toward the bridge, where there was a set of stairs leading down to the water. In front of her, a boxy Genetrix taxi collided with a sleek BMW. The drivers both got out and started yelling at each other, one of them waving a siphon on his left hand that looked like a metal glove. She sprinted down the steps and slid to her knees at the river's edge, where she had seen the man in the water. Mox spluttered, shoving his hair away from his face, and Sloane threw her arms around him, half plunging into the river, her hips flat against the concrete. "Your ear is bleeding," he said. "Perforated eardrum," she said. He crushed his mouth against hers, graceless. She tasted river water and dust from the monument site and blood. He was alive. She heard coughing and tore herself from Mox to see Esther a few yards away, braced on the edge of the river on her elbows, hacking up water. Sloane stumbled over and pulled Esther out of the water by her arms. "Essie," she said. Esther coughed into Sloane's shoulder, clutched at her shirt. "Where's Matt?" I don't know," Esther said. Over Esther's shoulder, Sloane saw Ziva dragging something out of the river. Water poured out of the hole in her jaw as she heaved Matt onto the shore. He coughed and rolled onto his side. Esther said weakly. The Dark One. Is he... dead? Sloane said. There were spots of his blood on her sleeve. Yeah. He's dead. They walked across the bridge in a pack. Sloane led the way, and Ziva and Mox loped behind. Matt was leaning on Esther for support, the pain from his crushed hand having finally hit him. They passed people huddled next to the railing, looking confused. One of them was a teenager wearing ripped jeans and Converse sneakers, no siphon. Up ahead, Sloane spotted the 17th Church of Christ scientist, a squat stone pod of a building that stood where Wacker split in two. The building that Sloane vaguely remembered being behind it, though, was gone, replaced by an unrealist structure that peeled apart like a banana at the top, sending offices in all different directions, arching over the street. They turned right on Wacker, ignoring the screams that were now coming from everywhere and the alarms that drowned them out. We have to find Inez, Esther said from behind her. And my mom. The phones, Sloane said. They probably won't work. There were power lines in the street, wires severed by buildings, by gas-burning streetlights. Then I'll drive to California, Esther said. First, find Inez, Sloane said. You two can go together. She didn't add if she's alive, because she refused to acknowledge the possibility that she wasn't. Go to Mexico on the way back, if you can, maybe. And I'll... She trailed off before she could say that she would look for her mother, because she suddenly felt sure there was no way her mother was still alive. Though why she was so convinced, she couldn't have said. When she saw the Camel, not the Thompson Center, ahead of them, she almost fell to her knees with relief. They would need the collective magical knowledge the Camel offered if they were going to survive whatever was happening. Her ears were ringing as they passed through the front doors of the Cordis Center and wove through the lobby, which was full of confused Genetrixe people yelling at one another over the din. A security alarm was going off, and it was hard to think of anything beyond the blaring. Soldiers from the Army of Flickering were here and there, shouting for everyone to calm down. Esther and Sloane both watched, quiet. Sloane swallowed her rising hysteria. What happened? She said, her voice breaking. Is this Earth or Genetrix? Esther looked around at the chaos in the Camel lobby. A little of both, I think. The first sign that Inez might be alive was that her apartment building was still standing. It hadn't been a given. Esther, Matt, and Sloane had walked along the lakefront path to get here, leaving Mox and Ziva to locate the rest of the Resurrectionists' army. And they had turned on Wilson Avenue to walk through Uptown, where the peace of the waterfront had given way to madness. Some buildings were split down the middle, with half a living room exposed to the street, or a bathroom sink hanging over the edge of a divided floor, about to tumble to the ground. They passed a kitchen floor that sagged over an alley, dropping tiles when the wind blew. A ladder was braced against the side of the three flat, and a man was climbing into one of the windows of his second floor apartment while his small daughter stood on the ground and shouted instructions. The bear with the missing ear, she cried out. Her eyes were full of tears. Do you see him? Farther down the street, Sloane saw another one of those broken buildings, but with an arm and a leg hanging from one of the split floorboards of a third-story apartment. She tried not to look at it. Across the street from Inez and Albie's building, where there had once been a dark pub, was a Genetrix park with a colorful statue standing in the middle of a small pond. Magical lights danced just under the surface of the water, unaffected by the collision of worlds. What is it? Esther said. Sloane had been staring at the park for a long time. That shitty pub that gave Inez food poisoning is gone, Sloane said.
You hated that place,
Matt said. And not quite like he was reminding her. More like it was a revelation.
Yeah.
Sloane frowned. Inez, Esther said. Remember? She tugged Sloane by the elbow. Come on, guys. The buzzer was broken, so Sloane forced her way through the front door. The lock had never been entirely secure, and climbed the stairs to Inez and Albie's apartment. Now that they were here, she couldn't bear the thought that Inez wasn't in the apartment. Esther had to drag her up the last few steps. She pounded on the apartment door. Inez! Inez, it's Essie! Open up! Sloane braced herself for silence. But she heard footsteps right away, and Inez's low voice as she fumbled with the locks. Oh my God, oh my God, she was saying over and over again, wiggling the door back and forth in its frame. The door opened, and Inez was standing in front of them in her bare feet and a pair of drawstring pajama bottoms. Her eyes red and her hair tangled. She smelled like weed and sweat and coffee.
Where the fuck have you guys been?
Inez demanded. They all fell together like a house of cards, just barely holding each other upright. Chapter 45. That night, Sloane woke to a nightmare in which Albie's corpse climbed out of the river and shambled toward her. He croaked his condemnation for what she had done, for killing Nero, for destroying the better part of two worlds. She woke breathless and shaking. A candle flickered in the center of the kitchen table. Esther sat with a bottle of water on one of the stools, staring into the flame.
Esther, Sloane said, clutching a pillow to her chest.
I think I figured something out. Esther rested her cheek on top of the water bottle and looked at Sloane. Her eyes were soft with grief and tight with worry.
Your mom's alive, Sloane said.
She clutched the pillow harder, her heart pounding. She must be, because I love her. And all the things that survived the collision, they're all the things I loved in both worlds. She choked. My magic turned Nero's death into whatever this is. This fucking Frankenstein's monster world. So it's made up of all the things I wanted and... Esther got up and walked over to the couch. She sat next to Sloane so their shoulders were touching.
Some of the things I want, Sloane whispered, are not good. No one should get to make their own world.
I know, Sloane. Sloane shoved her face into the pillow she held and tried not to scream. Matt stepped out of Albie's room, where he had evidently been standing, hidden by shadow. He rustled in the kitchen cabinets for a few minutes while Sloane tried to get her grip on the pillow to loosen, then walked over to them, holding out a little yellow pill. Sloane swallowed it. The safe house was quiet. Someone had torn down most of the boards covering the windows, so sunlight filtered in through a layer of dust. Sloane passed the blankets wadded up by the door, her old bed, and the room full of soldiers, sitting together on the floor, playing cards, repairing siphons, and in the case of one group, drumming on old pots with their bony fingertips. She went to the storeroom to look for Mox and found him sitting at the little table across from Ziva. Their hands were clasped, his big, warm palm all but encompassing her wasted knuckles.
Sloane,
Mox said, and they jerked away from each other like they had been caught doing something embarrassing.
Sorry, I can come back,
Sloane said. She felt like she had interrupted something.
No, stay, Ziva said. I was just telling him about a conversation you and I had. Over time, Sloane was sure she would be able to tease out each thread of the knot of the past few days. But it was too soon for that. After taking the benzo, she had fallen into a heavy sleep on Inez's couch, then woken up, borrowed clean clothes, and with Inez's help, hot-wired a car to drive across the city. But that was all she had managed so far. What she had gathered, however, from conversations in front of the bodega down the street from Inez's place, was that no one had internet, cell service, or electricity. People in the earth sections of the city had begun to poke their heads out into the Genetrix parts out of curiosity and desperation, since the Genetrix A people had fared better in the wake of the disaster because their siphons were still functioning. But then the shopkeeper started ranting about sorcery, so that was the most she had learned about the state of the world around her. A conversation we had, Sloane repeated. About whether I was glad to be alive again, Ziva said. She worked her jaw up and down for a few seconds until it clicked. Sloane watched her tongue move behind her exposed teeth and wondered how, in just a few days, her disgust for Ziva's rotting body had all but disappeared. Ah, Sloane said. Z and I decided it's time for her to go, Mock said. He was staring at the table. Oh, Sloane said. She didn't seem to be capable of speaking more than one syllable at a time. Ziva nodded. Nero's dead, which means the consul is out of danger and no longer needs us. I've spoken to the others, and they agree. I'll always need you, Mox said fiercely. All of you. Mox, Ziva said, with as much gentleness as Sloane had ever heard in her rough, dry voice. She had also never heard Ziva use Mox's name. He was always Consul or Sir. Mox looked up at Ziva. She covered his hand with hers again. You'll miss us, Ziva said. Want us. But that's something else entirely. Mox didn't respond, which was as good as agreement. Let's do this now, while Sloane is here, Ziva said, getting to her feet. That way, I won't worry about you as much. Now? Mox choked a little on the word. There is never a good time, Ziva said, to let go or to rest. Ziva gave Sloane a crooked smile. Sloane returned it. Together, they went to the main room where the rest of the army waited. When Mox entered, they all started clamoring to their feet, some with more ease than others. The ones that were able-bodied helped the others up, or held detached limbs the way a husband might hold his wife's purse. Sloane would have a hard time imagining Mox making a speech, and he didn't surprise her. He wandered through the ranks of the soldiers, greeting them by name, speaking quietly into their ears, putting his arms around them. As he made his way through the crowd, Sloane wondered if he would be able to do it, if the depth of his desire for friends would guide his magic away from it. Sloane sat against the doorframe and watched. The soldiers who had already said goodbye to Mox began saying goodbye to each other. Two of the women closest to Sloane laughed about an old joke, raspy, choking laughs that sounded like dying. One of the men sat down with his back against the wall and his severed foot in his lap, his hand tenderly wrapped around the ankle. At last, Mox came to Ziva, who stood with her head high so her braid brushed the middle of her hunched spine. The sun was pale against her face, and bright, so it temporarily bleached away the green tint to her skin. Sloane tried to imagine what Ziva had looked like when she was alive,
her cheeks full and pink, her shoulders broad, her eyes gleaming. Mox held Ziva tightly, almost lifting her off the ground. Ziva's skeletal hand cradled the back of Mox's head as he spoke softly to her. Too quietly for Sloane to hear. Not that she was trying. All around them, the soldiers had gone quiet, sitting on the floor again in their small groups, around their decks of cards and makeshift drums and piles of colorful glass, the treasures of their wagers. Finally, Mox pulled away enough to touch his forehead to Ziva's. When she collapsed, he was ready to catch her. A tension Sloane had not truly felt went out of the room all at once, like a change in air pressure. The bodies of all the soldiers went brittle and dry, unmoving. Mox lowered Ziva to the floor, his hair hanging in his face. Sloane stood and made her way to his side. For a while, she stayed silent, watching his shoulders shudder. But when he went still at last, she offered him her hand and led the way out of the safe house. And when the building went up in flames, she stood by the river and watched it burn with him. Inez sat in the driver's seat of an old Jeep Wrangler, swearing at the steering column. Mox sat beside her in the passenger seat, a toolbox on his lap, offering suggestions that only seemed to make Inez swear more. Sloane observed it all from the curb, where she was keeping watch. There was a lot of looting going on, as well as a fair amount of violence, and she had a pipe wrench in hand, ready to defend her distracted friends if necessary. The Jeep was parked on the street just outside Inez's apartment, which meant they were lucky to have gotten to it first. Most of the good cars had already been stolen, leaving only rust buckets and mopeds behind. "Hey." Matt stepped out of the apartment building carrying a few bottles of water in one hand. His other hand, the one that had been crushed by the siphon, was wrapped in a thick bandage. Cyrielle had found a genetrix doctor for him that morning. He offered the water bottles to Sloane and she took one. "Thanks."
"Just got back from our place," he said.
"Or rather, the public Genetrexe park that is now in place of our place."
There was a hint of accusation in Matt's voice. Sloane stayed quiet. He looked exhausted, his eyes puffy, and his shoulders slumped.
"If your whole theory is true,"
Matt said quietly,
"then our apartment is gone because you wanted it to be gone."
"It's not what you're thinking," she said. "That's a place I was dreading going back to, because I knew it would be hard. That's all." Matt nodded, but his jaw still looked tight. "You can have this one if you're eager to leave," Sloane said, pointing to the Jeep. They were all setting off on their own road trips. Inez and Esther were driving to California to check on Esther's mother, and then to Mexico to see Inez's family. Matt was going to New York to find his parents. And Mox and Sloane were heading to Central Illinois to find out if Sloane's mom was still there, or if her entire hometown had blinked out of existence. Sloane was terrified to find out, even though, deep down, she already knew it was gone. The worlds had combined according to her every whim, every preference, and every petty fear. She felt naked in a way she had not known was possible. But she was almost feverishly grateful that Matt was still here. That even though her desires were revealing themselves to be murkier and smaller than she had expected, she still wanted him to be in her world.
"No, I'd rather find something that's not a gas guzzler," Matt said. "It's a long drive to New York."
"You sure you want to go alone?" Matt nodded.
"I think I could use the thinking time, actually."
Their breakup felt real now that they were back on Earth, more or less. And Matt had met Mox, and they were quite literally going in different directions. But it was worse now than it had been before. Whatever misconceptions Matt had had about Sloane's mushy insides were gone now. All he had to do was look around at all the things she had destroyed to see the truth. A victory shout came from inside the Jeep Wrangler as the engine roared to life. Inez stuck her head out the window. And a full tank of gas, too. Okay, Sloane said. I guess I'll see you in a month. They had all agreed to meet at Inez's place then to take stock of things. She wanted to tell Matt so much. That she was sorry she hadn't saved their apartment. That she hadn't moved on from him as easily as it seemed. That she wished she were better. But their intimate drama seemed insignificant compared to the chaos around them. The uncertain fates of their families. So she stayed quiet. She handed a bottle of water to Inez and hugged her goodbye while Mox piled their bags in the trunk. Then she stood in front of Matt, unsure how to let him go. He leaned in first, wrapping an arm around her and squeezing her tight. She had only just begun to return the gesture when he released her. Stay safe, he said. You too. You're going to have to learn how to drive, Sloane said as Mox folded himself into the passenger seat. She had tried to find a car big enough to accommodate him, but that had proved to be impossible. At least the Jeep could handle the unstable roads on the drive south. Mox had found his wrist siphon in Nero's intact workshop in the Camel, and it was now on his hand. He had offered to find one for her, but Sloane knew she didn't need one. She had the needle. In the back seat were two bags, one packed with clothes, the other packed with food and other necessities. Sloane didn't generally approve of looting, but there was nothing left of her earthly possessions, and she couldn't access any of her money. Not that money was terribly useful right now anyway, with two standard U.S. currencies floating around. Money was just a bunch of green paper if you didn't have a government or a sense of order. Sloane started down Lakeshore Drive, which was mostly intact, having been similar in both universes. There were ridges and cracks where the different pavements had come together. But she had heard people talking about the road being drivable. Sloane hadn't wanted to make this trip. But as Mox had said the night before, maybe you just have to know. Someday, he might find that he had to know too, about his own family. Mox fumbled in one of the bags for something. When he was hunched over, Sloane looked at the bumps of his vertebrae. The spine siphon had come loose as Nero died, he had told her. It was at the bottom of the Chicago River. He produced a CD from the bag. Pet Sounds. Sloane smiled. As the first song came on, Mox said, I think I know why you really did it. Why I did what? Killed Nero. Oh? Sloane glanced at him. Why did I really do it? Because he was going to force me to do it, Mox said. You decided that if one of us was going to have to bear the burden of it, it would be you. So in the end, it wasn't revenge or inevitability or some other dark purpose. It was a kind of small mercy. There was definitely revenge in it, she said. Yeah, of course, Mox said. He tilted his head back and closed his eyes. But there was kindness in it, too. He reached across the gear shift and took her hand. They drove along Lake Michigan, and the water glittered in the sun.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Chosen Ones, written by Veronica Roth, performed by Dakota Fanning, Veronica Roth, Amy McFadden, Richard Ferrone, LJ Ganser, Natasha Sudeck, Gabriel Vaughn, Flynn Earl Jones, Victor Bavine, Carly Robbins, Robin Miles, Kyla Garcia, Isabel Keating, Emily Bauer, Vikas Adam, Eduardo Ballerini, Kevin T. Collins, and David Shee. Executive producers, Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Produced and directed by Chelsea Pita. Copyright 2020 by Veronica Roth. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.